Welcome to the Empowered Whistleblower Podcast. Are you one of many Americans who are tired of people being bullied and discriminated? You are not alone. Bullying has a rippling effect on the person who is being harassed and everyone associated with the bullied person. The targeted adult or child may have been physically or psychologically bullied. They often bring home their anguish with them, and this can have a crippling effect on everyone associated with the one who's being bullied or discriminated. It's time to shed some light on how to reduce bullying in the school systems, how to create safe and healthy work environments for employees. I blow the whistle on how to protect yourself if you're being bullied and educate listeners on their rights if they're being bullied or discriminated. I bring in the best experts who provide empowering strategies, tips on resiliency, how to handle the experience of being bullied or discriminated, how to heal and overcome the effects of being mistreated. If you are ready to gain knowledge and insights on bullying and discrimination, you are in the right place. Welcome to the Empowered Whistleblower Podcast. Hi, everybody. I am Dawn Westmoreland of the Empowered Whistleblower Podcast. I bet you didn't know that recently, or about a year ago, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission had a task force do studies of civility, what's going on in the workplace as far as bullying and discrimination. What they did come back with was civility training is not working. What is civility training? Well, that's the training where people go in and try to do prevention, you know, intervention. It's not working. So let's talk about who's coming on the show today. Today, Rob Jones, he is the president and CEO of Inclusive Works and In Good Works or In Good Company, LLC. And he is a Pittsburgh-based consulting firm with a unique and innovative approach to diversity and inclusion through management systems. Welcome, Rob.
How are you, Dawn?
I'm good. Yes, how's your weather there in Pittsburgh today?
Today, beautiful. We're drying out a little bit from some fairly big rainfall over the last couple of days, but we're doing okay now.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. So you have a really impressive background. As I was talking to you earlier, you're more of a mentor today because of all your experience. You've been a professor, you've been an executive coach, and you've been on many different boards. So when I was talking about that task force that got together and they started studying all the different companies, agencies, organizations, corporations, and they said that the civility training is not working because discrimination bullying seems to be on the rise. And depending on where you hear it from, it's up to 70%. So why do you think we're having problems? Why are there so many Equal Employment Opportunity Commission allegations of discrimination?
Well, that's a big question. Part of the answer, I think, is obvious to almost everyone. The political environment's changed quite a bit. There's no doubt that the things that we're seeing now always existed. Whether or not they surface is dependent on the amount of tolerance in the environment. And just to be as frank about it as possible, the tolerance levels for that kind of behavior has gone up a bit. There's sort of a political swing and a social swing toward openness of those kinds of behaviors as opposed to there being more covert or subtle. So the veil is off, more or less. You could call it the lifting of the veil. And I think that's been an important contributor, perhaps, to the number of cases that we see, the types of cases we see. Even if it's not all the way up to the legal case level, we each may see it in varying ways in the forms of microaggressions at the individual level, and even sometimes some pretty aggressive behaviors like bullying beginning to manifest themselves even more in our individual lives.
Yeah, right. So I know we've talked in the past about diversity, inclusion, and I know you have a program that you're working on, and you're going out into companies, corporations, you're doing executive leadership coaching. Can we talk about what is working, what you are doing that is working?
Yeah, there are a few things that maybe we can mention first. In terms of the EEOC and the civility issues, when the studies go in and show that civility training isn't working, that may be a little bit of a misleading way of stating it. One of the things we have to do is determine what we mean by works. And when organizations do those kinds of studies and those kinds of interventions, their objective isn't always to completely stop the behaviors. That may be an unrealistic expectation. But if we compare it to diversity, for example, we might all agree that the demographic makeup of the country, for example, is very much the same as it was many years ago, decades ago even. And it's simply the distribution of that diversity in varying societal stratas that's perhaps different than it was. Pittsburgh may be an example where in 1950s, the African-American population was about 25%, between 25 and 30%. And today, it's actually about the same in the city of Pittsburgh. But the way it's distributed through the city is perhaps a bit different than it was in the 50s and also in the workforce. So the idea of managing the diversity in ways perhaps that it hadn't been managed before is really the objective of those kinds of interventions. So when you say that civility training isn't working, well, that may be the case if you view it at the individual level, where people may not be as civil with one another as we'd like, mm-hmm. but managing that within the organization as an objective of the training may actually be working and helping the organization resolve those kinds of conflicts or manage those kinds of conflicts a little bit better. So to swing it back over to the diversity side, we saw a historical progression in the way what we call diversity is managed today. Initially, and I say initially because, my life started in the 1950s. I've been around for a while. It was just called struggle. That was pretty much the term for it. And it reached a pinnacle in the 1960s, at which point there were some legislative remedies and some other things that happened that moved it into the arena of changing law and changing the way the country governed or managed its diversity. From there, there were some back and forth issues in the legal environment that ended up between 1965 and 1980, roughly, ended up in what we today may know as the Bakke decision. It was really a pivotal decision in a lot of ways at the Supreme Court in 1978. And without going into a lot of detail about it, it just simply set an upper control limit, an upper limit on how much change was going to be allowed and how quickly. And the casualty of that, in effect, was affirmative action. So we moved from struggle to legislation and into an affirmative action mode, equal rights, et cetera, for women and minorities. 1980, that pretty much came to an end, mm-hmm. and began to wind down into a different form. And what sprung up from there was the term diversity. And that term was actually mentioned in the Supreme Court decision as something desirable by Justice Powell, who was on the bench at the time. And so the management mode for diversity changed from one that was sort of strictly legal and numbers-oriented, representation-oriented, and affirmative action, and equal rights for women and the way it played out. Two, a fairly nondescript, less legalistic argument, and one that played more to social justice and morality in the form of diversity. So the interventions inside the organization that helped with things like civility and interpersonal relations and intergender relations, if you will, and a number of other things sort of all melded into something that was roughly defined as diversity. And in America, it became a melting pot construct inside business organizations. In Canada, it turned into sort of like a salad bowl or a jelly bean jar, sort of a paradigm or analogy. And in other places in the world, it played out in different ways in varying forms of interculturalism. So the types of interventions that came from those included civility, and even though it was very narrow in scope, it potentially could have some broad effects, just like the valuing diversity or embracing diversity or celebrating diversity came to be known in the United States. Unfortunately, the numbers haven't quite borne out what we'd hope to see in the way of progress from 1980 onward. And so thus you get a lot of the feedback that diversity doesn't work or civility doesn't work, when in reality, many of those interventions aren't designed to stop the problem, end it, and create something better. It's just very simply to manage those kinds of problems and conflicts inside the organizations. And that sort of spills out into society at large. The problems haven't stopped. They haven't abated. And in many cases, we may believe they're getting worse. But the idea still is to manage it as opposed to solving the problem.
I like that, what you said about managing, because there will always be issues with bullying and discrimination because we have people out there that are going to continue to do it. Now, I was reading your article in Medium, and you're talking about diversity accomplishing originally stated goals. I want to talk about your four different issues that you address. One was creating and maintaining an environment that naturally allows all individuals to reach their full potential in pursuit of organizational objectives. Can you speak to that?
Sure. Naturally, when an organization hires someone, and I've been in a few organizations that have hired a lot of people, the idea isn't to bring people in and shut them down. Oftentimes, the corporate culture, the organizational culture, may begin to serve that purpose. But what you would always hope to see is pretty much the way the diversity paradigm began to shape itself in the 1980s, that you would bring folks into an environment that would enable them to just do what they were brought in to do. Mm-hmm. The term neutrality that I use actually kind of caught my attention a decade or two ago. I've known about it and studied it prior to my sort of wake-up call for using it. But when you bring someone into an organization, there's usually a culture there already, and the person brings something new to the culture no matter what you do. So the idea here actually can be played out by biologists and in petri dishes. They can take a culture that's of bacteria in a petri dish and then introduce a different strain And that different strain of bacteria will have an impact on the existing culture inside the dish, and vice versa. The ideal kind of a substrate to study the two different kinds of cultures in the same dish is known as a culture-neutral substrate in the biological field. So what that means is you can put two different cultures in the same dish, allow them to interact as they would normally interact, but the substrate on which they sit is going to be beneficial for both of them, so they can both do what they do. Mm. As it turns out, as we're learning more about that, our stomachs and our intestinal tracts are actually ideal for that, because there's all kinds of what are called biota in there now, or known to be there now. And they all interact and do what they do just fine down there, as long as we don't do, you know, silly things to get in the way. So allowing people to become what they can become is the idea of bringing into an organization and hiring in a way that's said to be inclusive, meaning that we want you in, we brought you in to do your job, and anything that interferes with that job is not good for the company as well as the person. One of the illustrations I use in teaching is that of a copier. If we brought a copier in and we found that the copier wasn't working well, we, of course, call in a repairman. And the repairman might make the repair and leave. And if the copier experienced the same problem shortly thereafter, we'd begin to wonder if we made a good decision about the copier. Call the repairman back. If the repairman discovers the same problem or something similar, he'll make the fix and he'll leave. If, though, we found out that one employee was sneaking in after work and sabotaging the copier, maybe sticking a screwdriver in it, rattling it around in there and breaking things, and then leaving, what do you think we would do as a manager once we found that out?
Yeah, very good point. And I know, working in human resources for 27 years, how important it is for people to get along, to have safe, respectful environments, diverse environments, that when there's problems in the workplace, that employees may reach out to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission or a state agency like that. And these can take 4 to 5 years to reach a hearing, and this is without retaliation. If there's retaliation, I know that gets bumped up, it gets triaged up. So that can really tie up a company with paperwork, investigations, interrogatories, and such. You bring up a second point about teaching employees to promote, recognize, and value differences and similarities. Could you expand on that, Rob?
And we can sort of follow through on that copier illustration. If we find out that the employee is sabotaging the copier because it's a Japanese copier and they feel we should be buying American products, we would no doubt sit down and have a little reasoning session with that employee. Whether or not we would dismiss them is one thing, for destroying or sabotaging company property. Many companies would. It would just be an automatic. But we don't do that with people for some odd reason. So when we see things like incivility, bullying, perhaps insubordination, or perhaps, overbearing managers that perhaps have very difficult interpersonal styles, sometimes we just let that go as employee relations folks and don't intervene until it becomes a formal complaint or until it becomes a social problem inside the organization that is disruptive to the work. So the idea then is, you've often heard the term employees are our most valuable asset.
Mm-hmm. I have.
Most often copiers are treated as more valuable assets than employees, because if we found out someone was banging on the copier in the middle of the night, we wouldn't tolerate that more than once. So the value of employees then becomes a relative issue. It shouldn't be. If employees really are our most valuable asset, then the kinds of things that simmer inside organizations need to be monitored, tracked, measured, responded to as quickly as possible in order to keep the environment inside the organization positive as it can be for everyone. So those are the things that when we read Harvard Business Review or MIT Sloan or a number of other management literature, you read some of the Fortune and Inc. Articles and others inside workforce what they're all beginning to point to are things that boil down to creating an environment that is neutral in nature so that the organization isn't participating in the struggles that come in from the outside. They're shielding employees from the externalities or the conflicts that roil outside of organizations and in society at large. And they're trying to teach them how to behave with one another at what you could call the quantum level, just the person-to-person relationships that make things work. And I think that's what that points to a bit. I think I can't remember which article in Medium. I've got a number of them out there, but one of them references an MIT Sloan article that was published by a Harvard leadership professor that actually talked about a culture-neutral environment, why we need that inside business organizations, why we need to frame our organizations as neutral with respect to conflict, especially social conflict, and then help everyone be what they can be.
Yeah. Well, you've been so busy. I'll tell you the title that I'm looking at in Medium is called Case Study 18, Seeds of the Culture Neutral Framework.
Ah, okay.
You've been busy, Rob.
Yeah, I've got a few of those out there. I think at this point, in addition to some of the other posts, I've got close to 35 or 40 case studies. Eventually, I'll pull them all in and put them into a single publication, but I'm working to get some reactions to them. So feel free, if you're listening, to pop out into Medium, look for me, and find some of those case studies. I also have a number of them on LinkedIn, slightly different versions.
Yeah.
Under my profile.
Definitely check it out. So a third point you talk about is starting point for building crucial organizational capabilities as a component of change strategy. What is that about, Rob?
Big question. That began to take shape back in 1995, actually between 89 and 95. The company I was with at the time was a Fortune 500 energy company, and I was in one of the operating subsidiaries here in Pittsburgh. And they undertook a diversity intervention in 1990 or so. They started planning for it in 89. An absolutely brilliant diversity consultant. The company is still around today, although unfortunately the creator of that organization has since passed. But she was absolutely brilliant, did a wonderful job, and helped the company to actually take a much more proactive role toward building an organization that actually served the primary objective of helping people be who they could be and what they could be inside the group, inside the organization. Interestingly, though, it was sort of a one-time opportunity for me and maybe for a lot of other people. There was a large organization with about 6,000 people in it. My subsidiary had less than 2,000. And the rest of the organization chose in different states. We had operating companies in 5 or 6 different states. None of them chose to do diversity interventions at that time. Ours was the first one in. So I was able to do a test and control group study over a 5-year period that looked at the key behaviors that organizations should manifest in order to make diversity work. 6 what I called key behaviors at the time were preconditions that needed to exist and then improve over time to create a better environment for diverse employees and for all employees, actually. The test and control group used some of the operating, one of the operating companies that did not have diversity and consciously chose not to do the diversity intervention. And compared it to ours, we used management level folks, middle management, and finite time task teams that had specific work to do, a time when it had to be finished, and well-documented teamwork so that we could find those groups, survey those folks, figure out how well they were working together and whether or not they manifested the key behaviors. We had the same kind of ability to monitor teams in the control group as well as the treatment group. And over the 5-year period, and by the way, I guess this kind of gets back to the opening, one of the opening questions. Over the 5-year period, we tested to see whether the behaviors in the group that had the diversity program were significantly different from those same behaviors in the group that didn't have the diversity programs. Surprisingly, there was almost no difference between the test and control group after 5 years of diversity training in the operating company. And again, specifically, they were middle management task teams that we studied, small group decision making and interaction. And boy, that was a little bit of a shocker. It was a shocker for everybody.
It's a shock for me, yeah. Even.
Well, it plays back to the original question of, why civility training studies may show that it isn't working. You and I intuitively know that civility almost always works. It's a great thing,
yes,
to be civil with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great thing to value one another and appreciate ways that we vary from one another as human beings. But in the end, humans aren't that. I think Anthony Bourdain has been in the news recently.
Yes.
His unfortunate demise.
Yes.
And in one of the shows he did with President Obama as his guest, the president made one very simple statement that resonated with Mr. Bourdain, and it was that when you travel the world and you get to know folks, you start to understand that we're not all that different from one another.
Mm.
We all basically want the same things for ourselves and for our family. All the rest is details. So, it's not a surprise that if you focus on differences rather than the things that you all want that are similar to one another, then we create needless divisions between ourselves. And therefore, some of the behaviors that may make us better, we don't get the opportunity to manifest relative to things we have in common if we're focused on elevating our differences to the main thing that we focus on. So some of that showed up in the research over that 5-year period that there were a couple of things going on in the environment at the time. In the energy industry in particular, it was turbulence. No other way to describe it. With sort of a more socio-pseudo-scientific term was non-equilibrium. The industry was in an intense environment of deregulation and merger and acquisition was big. Companies going belly up, all kinds of other things happening. So as a result of that, the equilibrium that many of us experienced in the decades prior to that, where you could come into an organization, work there for 30 years, and then go home, with a good career under your belt, everybody sensed those days were gone. They're pretty much no longer in existence anywhere. So the state of non-equilibrium the organization was in just proved not to be the kind of neutral environment in which people could be the best that they could be. So things like civility, things like valuing diversity and appreciating differences played a lesser role in both the test and control group, and they focused more on the task, the work, and getting the job done. And so almost all of the measurements were about how well the job got done as they defined the job, as opposed to how well people worked together and the efficiency, the effectiveness on the interpersonal side. So the surprising result was that there is a social environment, and then there is a task environment or work environment. And sometimes the two simply don't meet. People are able to do their jobs and do fairly well, even when the environment isn't really conducive for social behaviors. And so the diversity interventions, like the civility interventions, focus on maybe the social construct and tend to treat it as if it is separate from the work construct. Today, millennials aren't buying into that theory.
Yeah.
They're just come in, put your head down, focus in on the desk and get to work. It is not the way people think today. It was more manifest back then when the study was done. Mm-hmm. But that study is extremely valuable in terms of being able to understand that if we don't treat social and task as being essentially the same, we may do a very good job at getting work done right up to the point where the organization collapses. And we've seen that in a number of cases, like Enron, for example. Oh, I apologize for that.
That's okay.
Like Enron, for example, or at one point MCI, when they had some major issues, other organizations and even whole countries don't pay much attention to the social fabric. They're more concerned about some of the perhaps hard economic indices. And as a result of that, they end up collapsing without ever really understanding what went wrong, except in retrospect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to go back to the fact that you were talking about, bullying in the workplace. And with my background in HR, and I have worked in labor relations, I think one of the most frustrating things to human resource people and management is the fact that when supervisors know that there are bullying in the workplace or discrimination, that they're not properly documenting it and addressing it head on, that sometimes down the road we find out it's not been documented. And if it's not been properly documented and addressed in a proper manner, then it leads to it can lead to the worst nightmare for a company, a corporation, or an agency. So your last question, or not question, but your point is that an organization development activity that enhances team building and values clarification. You've been talking about everybody getting along. Could you clarify what you mean about that?
About getting along?
About enhancing team building and values clarification.
Ah. Well, yeah, There are a few things, again, I can sort of plug the study a little bit, but there are key behaviors that enable people to get along. Oftentimes we just use the term communication, and so whenever problems develop, what we tend to want to do is dialogue. We use that term a lot. We need to open up dialogues. We need to have discussions. But there are preconditions that exist that make those discussions more effective and make us more effective in our communication with folks. So communication is a very big term. In order to help people get along, you have to sort of break it down into smaller pieces. And so there are again, what some of the experts will call preconditions or antecedents to being able to communicate effectively. If those aren't there, even attempts to communicate, sincere attempts, are going to fall flat. So, for example, one of the abilities that we focus in on in terms of measuring the level at which it exists inside organizations is called decentering. We measure both individual and organizational ability of the employees and even team members to step into the shoes of another person, sort of transfer to the other person's cognitive position. It's the opposite of egocentrism or ethnocentricity. It's more like empathy, but it's actually compassion. I'm not a big fan of empathy.
Okay.
There's a great little book out there. It just occurred to me called Against Empathy. I think was the title of it.
Okay.
Yeah, and the name of the author will come back to me, but it's a brilliant little book. Just out maybe last year. And if you have an opportunity to pick that up, it explains the fundamental difference between empathy and compassion. And compassion actually is the better way to go. And it also just plays to our ability to decode what other people are saying based on our own awareness of their messaging and their background and what it means. You've probably heard the term code switching. That's become popular in the last decade or so. And it just means being able to pick up on what the other person means. We each use different nuances in language and body language, verbal, and even in the way we hear things, we're each a little different in that regard. So when we get to a level where we're able to step out of our own way of receiving information and receive it more like we think the sender is attempting to send, that's kind of called decentering. And so we step out of our cognitive center, get into somebody else's. Although technically, again, it plays back to neutrality where we're not necessarily stepping into the sender's shoes. We're just stepping into a space where we all have an equal standing in our little circle of trust and make the best of assumptions about people, that no matter how much they throw their hands when they speak or how loud their voice may be or how intense their communication may be, or how withdrawn they may be on the other side and sort of introverted and maybe timid. We don't draw the wrong conclusions from those automatically. We are open and decentered out of our own center of operation. So that's just one of a number of things that we can measure to establish as a precondition for effective communication. Helping people to get along better can be a timeout. Although those generally aren't effective because they're temporary measures. Well, organizations tend to teach getting along and things like civility in ways that mask the problem as opposed to help people get to the root of it through more effective communication. So, you know, again, that kind of goes to why we do need to continue to work to help people get along better. But it also plays to why we need to understand the mechanics of communication more effectively and measure where we are and how much our work groups may understand that and the individual mechanics, and then work on those specific skills as opposed to just things like broad communication and dialogue.
So you are a social scientist. You've been a teacher, professor, you're executive coach, you're doing consulting. What have you learned from all of this at this point around diversity, inclusion, cultural neutral?
What have if I had to pick one or two big things, I've learned a lot.
I bet you have.
And not necessarily just from the consulting work, but some of life's experience with the organizations that I've had the privilege of working with. One that just sort of leaps to the top of the heap here was an organization that was for victims of sexual assault here in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
I was recruited to that board of directors as, I like to say, I was the first male on that board. But I was actually, there was one other male recruited at the same time. So we kind of got, I'll just say we got stuck in the door together on the way in.
Stuck in the door. Wow.
Yeah, but I... But I ended up staying and actually ended up becoming the board president for that organization and stayed in there, did a lot of work for about five or six years. The board of the organization, the members of the board at that time were primarily in the LGBT community.
Mm-hmm.
The organization was 30 years old. They were looking to do some culture change. They knew about some of my work and brought me in to help them transition to a different kind of board leadership and some different thinking in the organization. And I can tell you, there couldn't have been more different thinking between me and the board and some members who had been on that board as long as 30 years from the inception of the organization as radical feminist advocates and activists. So the needless to say, learning was fast. It was a fast learning curve. Mm-hmm. And I was very fortunate to have a group of women who allowed me to make a lot of mistakes and to continue to grow with the organization. So if I had to, and the reason why that one came to mind for your question, you know, what have I learned? What I learned is that you can have intense differences in the way you see things, but if you continue to hammer away on trying to get someone else to see your point of view, you're doomed to failure. So what's the alternative? You know, I mentioned one alternative, which was to focus purely on the work on the other side. That also is ultimately doomed to failure if the organization is going to stay around for the long term. So the term that I use in the middle to define the nature of the environment on the social side is equilibrium, which is very different from balance. The most important thing I've learned is that there are huge forces that impact on an organization and on people, and there are a number of smaller forces that impact on people and organizations. And if you picture the big force on one end of a seesaw and the small forces on the other end of it. The only way to get equilibrium or to get those to balance out is to move the fulcrum one way or another, or make it larger. It's Archimedes and the law of levers. So rather than use the term balance, I really feel that equilibrium is the right term to use, and the fulcrum and lever principles involve the way you treat the organization and its governance as the sort of the seat of the seesaw, and the fulcrum in the center is really teams in the organization and how well you teach teams to work together and get along with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And you can move that from one side to the other. I have a little model out on the website, I think. But and it's just pretty much, you know, what you would expect, just a big hunk of something on one end, a small hunk on the other end, and that fulcrum is moved toward that big hunk in order to balance out the small forces with the large. That equilibrium is so important in our individual lives, in our interpersonal relationships, in our families and small groups, in the business organizations and community organizations we serve, and even in our cities and in our country. Looking for that equilibrium is really the key, as opposed to looking for balance or looking for which way is best, a mission orientation or a pure relationship orientation. It's just one of the most important things we can do is to achieve equilibrium in our lives.
Good points. And you've done so much over the past years. I know you started, or you were a member of the African American Chamber of Commerce. And my goodness, Rob, I wish we could go on and on and on, because this is my talk too. I mean, I love this kind of conversation, but we have to wrap up. And what I'd like you to do is tell people how they can contact you, if they'd like to hire you, connect with you. You have so much to offer. So share with our listeners the best way to reach out to you, please.
Easiest way is to grab my website, which is inclusiveworks.com. Spelled just like it sounds, INCLUSIVEWORKS.com, and there is a contact us tab, and that will be the absolute best way to grab hold of me.
Fantastic. Well, we learned so much today from you, Rob. I thank you for being on the show. And for anybody listening in, please reach out to Rob. He brings a different perspective to what diversity is all about, inclusiveness, and I'm so grateful to have this conversation today. Stay tuned for the next episode of The Empowered Whistleblower. Everyone have an empowering day. Thank you for listening to The Empowered Whistleblower. As your host, I will continue to bring in the best experts to share their knowledge and empower our listeners. Nobody has to feel like a victim. There are solutions to bullying and discrimination. Everyone deserves to be treated with respect and dignity. All our future shows will offer practical guidance so that anyone can choose to stand up to bullying and discrimination. You deserve to be happy, and life is all about choices. I always welcome comments and suggestions for new shows. Please comment and share your ideas. And be sure to come back for more inspiration and empowerment. I am Dawn-Marie Westmoreland signing off and wishing you much happiness and empowerment in your day.